Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you.
I understand you have 20 minutes, is that right?
I believe so.
You wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Pardon me?
Do you wish to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Do I have time left?
To see how it goes?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, we'll do that.
Roll with it.
Okay.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. I'm Pat Carney, I'm here on behalf of D'Aris Trice, appellant in this matter. This is a Madison County case that was before you previously, jury instruction issue, in fact, secondary trial. That one did not have a jury. He was convicted and sentenced to 40 years. There's several issues that arose during the course of this trial. The first deals with unavailability of a witness. And there was a couple of witnesses. Robin Baldwin had testified at the first trial. For the second trial, she was subpoenaed but didn't show up, and so the court accepted her prior testimony over objection.
Let me interrupt you, Mr. Carney. Other than a subpoena, how do you, or the state for that matter, ensure that a witness will show up? What are the procedures or mechanisms to make sure that somebody shows up other than a subpoena?
Well, there's a subpoena, and that's the question, and I think this court can offer some guidance out there.
Well, is there such a thing as an arrest warrant?
I think there is a warrant. I think the court has the authority to issue a warrant. The prosecutor can ask that that be issued, send out law enforcement to pick the witness up.
Go ahead.
And that's where we're going with this. The statutory exception identifies if they're absent from the hearing and the proponent of the statement's been unable to procure the attendance by process or other reasonable means. And so I think that last part of the sentence is where we're focused in on.
Does the record reflect that the prosecution knew prior to the actual hearing that this witness wasn't going to show up?
It's inferred in there. The deputy that served the subpoena testified, and that deputy identified she displayed some hesitancy for the trial. So, yes, the deputy had that knowledge. The prosecutor...
What exactly did he say that hesitancy was? Was it, I'm not going to show up, or I've got to go to work, or...
She indicated, through the deputy, I don't know what she said, but the deputy indicated the statement was, well, I've had a threat, so I don't want to show up.
So is there anything in the record that she continued to live in Madison County?
She was served in Madison County. The deputy's testimony was, I asked him, well, how did you find her? Well, I called her on her cell phone, and she agreed to meet with me. So knew I was coming. Went to her house, handed her the subpoena. So they had her. They had an address, obviously. Had her cell phone. Had the ability to get over. And that's the... This somewhat has to be a case-by-case basis, but I think in this particular case, it made a lot of sense when that witness did not report as the subpoena ordered on the first day of trial. That's a clear indication to the county attorney's office, hey, we may have a problem here. An easy fix is, judge, we need to contact this witness and get her in here. His staff could have called the witness, identified what the issues were, whether she was available or not available. If they would have asked the court, I'm sure the court would have allowed them a warrant to go pick her up and bring her in.
How many days was the trial, and what day was the witness supposed to testify on?
The witness was subpoenaed for the first day. It was a two-day bench trial. And I guess, whether or not there was a threat, I don't know, or where it came from, or the extent to which it was. None of that was ever laid out. But I know that this court has identified that an unwillingness to testify is not tantamount to unavailability.
Who has the burden of showing unavailability?
the prosecution does. The person, the proponent of the statement, has the burden to show the unavailability. They put on the deputy that served. The witnesses for that issue were the deputy that served the subpoena.
Does the record show there was any testimony as to where her employment was, or if she had any relatives or parents in Madison County, or anything of that nature?
I don't recall the testimony going into the family. Her sister did testify live in the trial, so obviously her sister was available to the prosecutor. The deputy indicated he didn't have any problem whatsoever getting her served.
Did anybody ask the sister, "Where's your sister"?
I don't know if that was asked on the record.
On the record.
I don't recall that. Her sister, I believe, was called in state's rebuttal. So I think on this particular issue, I think this court can offer guidance and remind the prosecutors they don't get a free pass just because they issue the subpoena. They have to follow up because of what the idea behind an exception of the hearsay requirement is, that, number one, live testimony ought to be. That should be fourth most in this.
And what did this witness, just in a very short summary, what did she testify to?
The witness testified that she overheard Mr. Trice, the defendant, and her sister, girlfriend, having a conversation outside of her home, wherein, this was the night of the party, the incident, wherein she claims that Trice indicated, "Well, if you're going to break up with me, I may as well go kill somebody or kill myself or spend my life in prison."
She testified previously and was subjected to cross-examination, right?
She was. In the first trial, this witness, that so Robin did.
Where is the prejudice that comes from this?
Well, and that's a valid question. The prejudice comes from the credibility. The sister, girlfriend, that was involved in this conversation, testified in the first trial. No, that wasn't said. Testified in the second trial. I don't remember that being said. I don't remember him ever making those statements during our conversation. So
the same trial judge tried both cases?
Yes.
So the trial judge not only had the cold record, but his recollection of her demeanor when she testified the first time?
Yes.
I mean, this isn't a jury trial, this is a bench trial.
The bench trial, yes.
That's why I'm really having a hard time seeing the prejudice here.
Well, you know, when the prosecutor is trying to build a fire of this murder, this is another piece to that. This is another log he's throwing on there. And if it's not important, then why is the prosecutor going to the lengths to put in the trial testimony? Or if he thinks it's important, thinks this is a good witness, they need to have that witness there testify. I think that should be the burden, and that is the burden of the prosecutor.
Is the inference in this argument that the state liked the testimony from the first trial, so they'll make the motion to try and get her back, but if not, she's unavailable?
I think the state was very comfortable with the testimony from the first trial. I don't believe the state felt they could be heard. But if it was a repeat. Whereas there were issues.
They knew what they had.
There were issues that absolutely could have been brought up as far as animosity between this Robin and Mr. Trice, the defendant, based on the relationship with Robin's sister. And that was not ever gone into in the first trial. Any issues that she would have had with the defendant and potential motivations to.
Or her testimony can be imbued with the passage of time and whatever that brings to testimony.
That's true as well. There was a second. This issue goes to a second witness, which was the defendant's brother, who had testified in the first trial. And the state had made an attempt to subpoena him,
was not successful in that attempt. It would have been an out-of-state subpoena. They had an address in Chicago. They issued a subpoena. It apparently, the testimony was that it went to the wrong address. And they hadn't realized that until shortly before the trial. They sent out another one, got it the right address, had contact with the Chicago PD, tried to get that served. Chicago PD went to the
address, and this was of Ronald, is the guy they're trying to serve. This was Ronald's parents' house that they went to and had communication with the parents and weren't able to locate. This one is a little bit different than Robin because they didn't get the subpoena issued. But again, I think when the state issues an out-of-state subpoena, there's some obligation on their part to make sure that it's been served, that they're following up with it. Didn't do that in a timely manner. I think they're benefiting from that mistake that was made.
Well, it's a little different. It's a different jurisdiction, and it's not in their home ballpark, and they don't have a lot of control over people in Cook County and getting it done. So
that's correct.
There's probably a little lesser standard there.
And I wouldn't disagree. They don't have that ability on the first day of trial for somebody out of state to say, Judge, we need an arrest warrant, and then you'll find him. I would agree with that, whereas Robin was in the county, knew where she was, had her phone number, would have been a terribly simple thing to go do there. But what I'm saying is, the second witness, Ronald, the brother, was an important witness. He offered quite a bit of testimony in the first trial. They've had a lengthy period of time between the first trial and the second trial to keep tabs on where he is and contact with him. They obviously had his parents' address, and they waited too long to start this process. And then there was a mistake in the process, and that compounded it. So I guess what I'm saying is, when we're looking at the unavailability hearsay exclusion, the prosecutor has the absolute burden to show that they've made diligent, reasonable efforts. And what I'm saying in this particular case, with this out-of-state subpoena, not diligent and reasonable efforts to get that witness here. That witness's testimony was also allowed in from the first trial over objection. And essentially the testimony there was, immediately after the party, as they were driving away, there was some questions and answers about, did you stab anybody, did you cut somebody? And his brother, Ronald, testified that Deers indicated, I cut somebody, but I didn't kill anybody. That was the testimony that came in the first trial. So that was, again, that's testimony that is hurtful to the defendant. It's testimony that's very helpful to the prosecution. And it would have been, and Judge, yes, he was there subject to cross-examination. I was not the original trial counsel. I was a different trial counsel for the second trial. There were some different information that I had come across. There were other questions. There was other theories that would have been brought down with Ronald Trice, the brother.
Counsel, weren't there other witnesses in the car that heard the same remarks?
There were two other witnesses in the car, one of which was the girlfriend of Ronald, the girlfriend's mother. And their testimony, both the first trial and the second trial, was cast a little bit of doubt because they lied in court in original statements, lying. They were lying to the investigators about where Ronald Trice was during all of these events. And caught in those lies, they eventually came. What they said then was, oh, now here's the statement.
And they both testified as to the statements made in the car.
They both testified, yes. So there were others, Ronald, though, being the brother, and Terry. Than these other two witnesses. So the idea there is this: the prosecutor has to bring diligent efforts to get them to make them an attendance at the trial. As
far as, that's all I have on the unavailability. Other questions on that particular issue. The next assigned error is that inadmissible hearsay was allowed in. And you have witness Guadalupe Reyes testify immediately after her boyfriend, Jerron Ford. Jerron Ford had offered testimony that he was at the party, that he saw the victim get stabbed, and that he went to the hospital and went home and then repeated that statement to Guadalupe. The testimony that came out was that Jerron Ford had snuck out of the house that Christmas night and without driving around and went to the party. And Guadalupe Reyes was upset with him for leaving, and there was going to be an argument when he got home.
On this issue, how much time intervened from the time of the stabbing to the time that he came home?
There would have been several hours that had passed. The witnesses weren't great historians on the time frames, but there would have been several hours that had passed.
Did anything in the record where he went after the stabbing? Did he go direct? Did he stay at the scene? Did he go someplace else?
His testimony was that he went to the hospital, stayed at the hospital for a while, and then at some point left. In the briefs, there appeared to be some confusion. His testimony was he left the hospital. He didn't know that. He didn't know until the next morning his victim had passed away. But in any event, the judge, in evaluating whether or not to let Guadalupe Reyes repeat Jerron's statement of, I saw somebody get stabbed, the court evaluated excited utterance and determined at the trial level that no, this didn't rise to an excited utterance level and was not going to allow it in on an excited utterance. And I think that was correct based on the demeanor of the witness. There were other things with Jerron Ford that I'm assuming brought the judge to that conclusion. With the other, the court did let it in as a prior consistent statement. However, in the briefs, the state concedes that he was not sufficiently attacked on cross-examination to allow the level to rise to the level of an attack that he had fabricated it.
So why would that not be harmless error?
Well, I think because you've got somebody who's claiming to be an eyewitness to this crime who has multiple discrepancies in his story, and those discrepancies were brought out with other witnesses later on during the trial and wrapped up in closing. He had discrepancies. There were a lot of discrepancies in his testimony. The state, I believe, knew that. They needed to prop up his testimony. And so they bring in this witness who wasn't at the scene, has nothing to do with it other than to repeat what her boyfriend, who was sneaking back into the house, had to say. So is it a harmless error? Again, why does the prosecutor feel that he needs to bring in this questionable material? And I would suggest that it's because they know they've got an issue with this witness. And I think it was error to allow that in. I don't think it rises to the excited utterance, and he was not attacked on cross to allow it prior consistent. Another assigned error was there was a phone conversation between Darius Streis and his father that occurred when he was in the jail in Madison County. That statement, a transcript of that conversation, was offered at trial over objection, and the judge allowed that in as an adoptive admission. The statement generally goes along the lines of, what are you pleading? How are you pleading? What's going on? The father identifies, is this not guilty? By what self-defense? Response of yes, and that's the end. It's a very short transcript.
Counsel, was the father's question a statement within the meaning of the hearsay definition?
Well, and that was part of an issue, too. There was an objection on the hearsay portion of this. And the transcript that the prosecutor's office wrote up had a question mark at the end. However, it could have just as well as been an exclamation point. So, and you are going to be not guilty. You are going to do it by self-defense.
So it's your position that what is portrayed in Exhibit 102?
Yes.
Is really not a question.
Well, I think there is a question about whether or not it's a question. And I think it could have been solved extremely easy by having his father come in and testify. As we saw with Ronald Trice, they tried to serve a subpoena at the parents' house. So it's not an issue that they don't know where they are, how to get hold of them. They, again, just didn't want that. They were comfortable with what they had and didn't want that to be a negative. To be a wild card.
Did he plead not guilty?
Yes, but not guilty. We had a trial, and self-defense was not, that wasn't a defense.
Not
followed.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You're out of time.
Thank you.
State may proceed. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Carney, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. With respect to the unavailability of the witnesses, Robin Baldwin had in fact been served with a subpoena, but when she was served, she indicated to Deputy Unger that she didn't really want to come to court to testify because she had been threatened in this matter.
Counsel, which way does that cut?
Well, it seems to me that it cuts, well, it can go both ways, I suppose, but I think because we understand she is reluctant to testify, she is still under a court order to appear and testify. She did not, in fact, show up the morning of trial, and the state undertook to some efforts to locate her. They had the clerk of the district court come into court and testify that she had had no contact with Robin Baldwin. Baldwin had not shown up in district court clerk's office to sign as a witness or in any other respect have contact with them. They also called Officer Baumeister, who they sent basically on a patrol around the courthouse to see if she was anywhere in the vicinity. And again, he knew who she was because he recognized her from the first trial and prior contact with her. He walked the entirety of the courthouse and said, I don't see her here anywhere.
Is that sufficient to just walk the halls of the courthouse to determine whether they're unavailable?
Well, it seems to me she's unavailable in that she has disregarded the court order to come to court, and she has completely blown off, if you will, her obligation to come and provide testimony. Could they have engaged in other activity? Yeah, they probably could have sent Baumeister or somebody out to her house and to her last known place of employment, if they have any idea what that is, to see if she happened to be there. If she had any sense, she'd probably be in Timbuktu that day. I think that...
But I guess what I'm asking, if they did find her and they still thought that she would be reluctant and not show up, is there some procedure, an arrest warrant for a witness to bring him into court?
Yeah, they can do that. Okay. Yeah, if you get a witness served with a subpoena, though, even if they say, "Geez, I don't really want to do this," literally 99% of the time they'll go ahead and show up anyway, even if they don't want to do it. But once they find out that she's not there, and apparently isn't going to be there, then I think the fact that they had undertaken all legal efforts to get her into court that day, and she had, in fact, been properly served with a subpoena and had chosen to disregard that obligation to show up, I think that the state had done not everything it could do, but it had undertaken reasonable efforts to produce the witness. And I think that based on the efforts that had been taken, the court properly found her to be unavailable.
What are your thoughts as to the prejudice, if any, because they used the testimony from the last trial?
I don't know that there was any prejudice. Her, The testimony that she provided, there's no indication that it would have been anything any different this time around. The second time around on a same trial is different for everyone. I'm sure while he may have had some different additional questions, the state may well have had the same, you know, different additional questions to ask her too, and everybody loses out in that respect. I don't know that he has demonstrated any particular form of prejudice from not having her be able to come in and testify again. With respect to Ronald Trice...
Were these different lawyers involved in the two trials representing the defendant?
I think it's the same firm, Your Honor. I think there were different attorneys for the first one, but I think it's from the same firm, okay, if that matters. With Ronald Trice, I would have been stunned if they'd have gotten him back for the second trial. They had to issue an arrest warrant for him to get him in for the first trial, and that was when he was still in the Norfolk area. He'd apparently, after the first trial, gone back to Chicago, and based on the state's information about his last known whereabouts, the state did the paperwork for an out-of-state witness subpoena, sent it to the district court, and the district court is apparently the party who sent it to the wrong address in Chicago. The state contacted the extradition unit in Chicago to where these out-of-state subpoenas go, and were told, oh, we never got that. So they started investigating and discovered it had been sent to the wrong address and promptly got out a second one to the unit in Chicago. And the people in Chicago said, well, we'll expedite this and try and get it served as fast as we can. Ultimately, about a week before trial, the Chicago unit gets a hold of the prosecutor's office and said, we had an investigator go out with the subpoena to the address, last known address for Ronald Trice, which is his parents' address. They told the investigator that Ron Trice is no longer in Illinois, so not is he only not in Chicago, he's just not in Illinois, period. But he might be planning on coming to the Norfolk area for the trial. They were unable to locate him to serve him with a subpoena, and no one was forthcoming about any particular different address where he might be contacted.
Well, how important were these two witnesses to the state's case in order to convict?
Well, Ronald Trice...
Both of them are testifying to an admission made by the defendant that he was going to kill somebody or he might as well do it.
And Ronald Trice also testified that after the stabbing, when they were in the car leaving the scene, he basically kept hounding his brother, did you do it, did you do it? The defendant kept denying it until finally he said, yeah, I did, I had to protect you and me. Ronald Trice had talked to Officer Bauermeister a few days after that, and then apparently the defendant changed his story, asked his brother to change his story to match his, which Ron Trice admitted that he did. I think their testimony is important to establish that the defendant had made admissions that he in fact did, that he in fact committed the stabbing. Well,
that's pretty strong evidence, isn't it? That somebody says the defendant said he admitted to doing it.
Yes, and the first time around there was the qualification that he said I had to do it to protect you and me. That was more important the first time in the first trial than it was the second one. Well, the first time, basically, his defense was self-defense. The second time around, his defense was, I didn't do it, I guess we'll move to the phone call between him and his father, which sort of fits in. Father was on the phone with his son and said, well, you're going to plead self-defense, and the defendant said, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Well, that was kind of... directly impacted first trial, and in kind of a sideways manner was important to the second trial, because the second trial he simply said it wasn't me. But the fact that his conversation with his father said I'm going to plead self-defense, which is technically called justification in the state, means that you have to admit the act in order to plead that you were justified in doing so. So again, it is an admission of guilt in this particular case, and that's why the conversation was important under these particular circumstances. Not that it had anything really to do with self-defense because his theory of his defense had changed the second time around, but because it constituted an admission that, yes, I did the stabbing, but at the time the statement was made, it was his intention that it would be, he would claim that it was a justified murder. Finally, with respect to Guadalupe Reyes, I think the district court incorrectly found that Hord's statement, the first time around, it was actually a prior consistent statement because of the way that the questioning of Jerron Hord went. Essentially, the police had had difficulty finding Jerron Hord because they'd been given an incorrect name. They sort of tripped across him while looking for somebody else and placed him under arrest for some outstanding warrants, sat down and went to talk to him about this particular incident, and Hord basically first testified that, well, no promises or requests had been made, but then I think it was Officer Bauermeister said, well, he asked me, well, what's in it for me?
But you're conceding that it's not a prior consistent statement.
I don't think it is. Under these circumstances,
so
I don't think it is.
So why is it, I think you're arguing that it's excited utterance.
Yes, I think it would be admissible as an excited utterance. If you look, there was this, had to have been a startling event. Yeah, he saw the fight and he saw a good friend get stabbed and ultimately he found out that he had been killed. A statement relates to the event.
But did he know that he was killed when he made the statement to Reyes?
Yes, I think he did.
And how much time elapsed?
From the time of the stabbing till the time he made the statement to Reyes, it's not entirely clear, but I think counsel is accurate. I think there's probably a few hours. He had left the party, gone to the hospital, and where his friend Tim Warren had been taken, and stayed around there for a while, and then left. And apparently, somehow, sometime between the time he left the hospital and the time he gets home, he is informed that Tim Warren is dead, is my understanding of the way the things read. Because when he gets home to Guadalupe Reyes, he's just a blubbering mess, and she was going to yell at him for running out on Christmas Eve, and he tells her not now, and she said he was crying, he was upset, he was very stressed, and I asked him what was wrong, and he said something to the effect of, I just saw my friend get killed. It seems to me that those statements, even though there has been some lapse of time, still falls within the excited utterance.
Did he say stabbed or killed?
I believe he said, I just saw my friend get killed. Because
what did Ms. Reyes testify that he said? And was it different than what he testified he said?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. Back up. I think he said, I've seen my friend get stabbed. I think that's what he said. I've seen my friend get stabbed, and I believe that's what Guadalupe Reyes also said. If the second time around, Hord might have testified. I don't have to check the record on this. I think he might have said, I saw my friend get killed. But I think Guadalupe Reyes' testimony was that he told her, I saw my friend get stabbed.
But it's your recollection that the record supports that Ms. Reyes testified he saw his friend get stabbed, not just my friend got stabbed.
No, my recollection is that he said, I saw my friend get stabbed.
Did the trial court at least implicitly and perhaps explicitly make a factual determination that the factual predicates for an excited utterance were not satisfied? And if that's correct, if it is a factual determination, how do we review that?
I'm not sure. My recollection is it didn't really go into the facts that much. It just kind of, the state offered up both prior consistent and excited utterance, and it just basically said, no, I don't really think it's an excited utterance. And I recall it saying something about the time passage, and apparently that was indicating to it that too much time had passed. But I think You review the factual findings for clear error.
Isn't that at least an implicit finding that he was no longer under the stress of the event?
It is, but I think the record refutes that. I think the testimony of the witnesses was that when he arrived home to Guadalupe, her testimony was that he was crying, he was very upset, he was very stressed out. And he said, I saw my friend get stabbed. I think to me, That clearly fits all three requirements for an excited utterance, and I think the district court, his factual findings are frankly, based on the record, clearly erroneous on that respect. I think the long and short of it is that it's harmless error because it's essentially almost duplicative of what Jerron Ford testified to. It isn't as critical this time around as it was the first time around because of the nature of the cross-examination of Jerron Ford the first time around where they were alleging an implied undue influence on him. This time around, there wasn't that, so I think that takes it out of the prior consistent statement category. Although I think it does fit under the excited utterance category based on the facts as they came out at the trial in this particular case. Your Honors, unless there are additional questions, we would ask that the judgment and sentence be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. There's no time for rebuttal, so we are adjourned and the parties are excused.